dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The broadcast spectrum nominally belongs to the people of the United States, and the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, is the federal agency responsible for licensing the use of the spectrum in order to assure that the public good is served. In practice, however, the FCC, under orders from Congress, has regulated the spectrum mainly for the benefit of media corporations, who in turn control the politicians' access to viewers and listeners. The passage of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 has already eliminated many of the regulations that in the past were designed to protect diversity and localism in media ownership. Since then, one company now owns more than 1,200 radio stations in the United States. That company, Clear Channel, based in San Antonio, Texas, was recently sponsoring pro-war rallies and had banned airplay of musicians critical of Bush. The present FCC Chairman Michael Powell, son of Secretary of State Colin Powell, wants to eliminate the few remaining barriers to ownership consolidation, so that one corporation might control the radio, TV, and newspaper in a given community. Powell is attempting to ram through these changes by the 1st of June, with little to no public knowledge that a decision that will fundamentally affect who controls what is news is about to be made. Public interest broadcasters and media democracy activists have raised the alarm and organized a series of hearings around the country to speak out against lowering the bar to further consolidation. For the next 2 weeks, we're going to bring you highlights from one of these day-long hearings, which took place in San Francisco on April 26th. Other hearings have been held in the past few months in New York City, Seattle, and Richmond, Virginia. Powell has claimed that since the 1996 Telecom Act was passed, the number of channels and forms of media have increased, thereby demonstrating that access to variety has not been harmed by media consolidation. But as you will hear tonight, both the panelists and the members of the public strongly disagree. The fact that not a single corporate media outlet has chosen to report on or broadcast discussion of these impending changes at the FCC supports critics' charges that the corporate media owners are providing a public disservice by stifling debate and the free exchange of ideas vital to a democratic society, and gearing their broadcasts to support their own political and economic interests. It's no coincidence that the hearings we're about to play you tonight were broadcast in the San Francisco area by only two radio stations, both not-for-profit, listener-sponsored, community radio stations. Now we take you to San Francisco City Hall.
Welcome. My name is Dorothy Kidd. I teach in the Department of Media Studies at the University of San Francisco, and I'm really excited to see you all here today for the hearing on the upcoming Federal Communication Commission rules on media ownership. I'm supported by my colleagues from the Communications Department of Stanford University, the Graduate School of Journalism of the University of California, Berkeley, the Communications and Entertainment Law Journal of Hastings Law School, and Media Alliance. I just wanted to say one thing. I think this is much more like what democracy looks like than what we've been hearing from the FCC today. So I'd encourage you to stay for the day and see what happens. The morning panel will be on news and civic discourse, but before that we have a couple of presentations from Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein and Ben Bogdikian, and I'm going to start by introducing the President of the Board of Supervisors of the City and County of San Francisco, Matt Gonzalez. Thank you.
First of all, I want to really welcome all of the folks that are going to be participating in the panel today, and particularly our distinguished guest, Commissioner Adelstein, who's here from the FCC. Welcome. I think that it's essential that we consider the recent FCC rule changes that are being proposed. I've been speaking to a number of people here today, and it's clear that the concerns related to media consolidation are very present in terms of the impacts on the diversity of opinion that we'll get through the homogenization of programming. And I think, unfortunately, these changes, again, show us the extent to which our nation is perceived as really a corporate nation instead of a nation that houses corporations. I also want to underscore that we should be concerned anytime our federal government or any commission such as the FCC wants to move with such speed. Chairman Powell has indicated he would like this to be decided by, I believe, June 2nd. And it's very reminiscent of the length of inquiry that we had as it related to the Patriot Act when our Attorney General indicated that he wanted that matter decided upon in a single week. But again, I want to thank those participating in this panel. I think you're going to find, as you hear public testimony, that those individuals here from San Francisco and the Bay Area are very thoughtful and highly opinionated, and it's one of the reasons San Francisco is such a great place to be from. Thank you.
Thank you. Our first speaker is going to be Jonathan S. Adelstein, who's a member of the Federal Communications Commission.
Well, thank you very much. Well, thanks for that welcome, and thank you all for coming out here to show your concern about this issue this morning. I see the sun came out for us today. I guess that means maybe we're on the side of the angels, or maybe they're the angels of the public interest. I want to say it's a real breath of fresh air to be here in the Bay Area, to get out of Washington, to hear your views about media consolidation. This hearing gives your voices an opportunity to join the emerging national dialogue that impacts everybody who lives here in the Bay Area. I'm especially thankful to Media Alliance for all the legwork they did in setting this up, and for the leadership and co-sponsorship of the leading academic institutions from this area. We got USF Media Studies Department, UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, Hastings Law School's Communications and Entertainment Law Journal, and Stanford's Communications Department. I'd add Stanford's my alma mater, so I'm honored that they would be a sponsor of this event, and I love that school dearly, and I love the Bay Area, so it's always a pleasure to get back here, especially to make sure that this community, one of the most important in the world, one of the sources of creativity and sources of inspiration for the rest of the country, to have an opportunity to hear about what's happening at the FCC on this issue, and especially an opportunity to express their viewpoints, the viewpoints of the experts and of the public, about what we're about to do. Because the FCC is about to make historic changes to our media ownership rules, and that'll affect each of you and each of us as media viewers and listeners. These current rules that we have in place that we're about to change are designed to prevent individual companies from gaining too much control over what we see, hear, and read. The public, and that's all of you, own the airwaves. We at the FCC are responsible for overseeing the airwaves in your interest, not in the interest of corporations that profit by using them. That's not just the moral thing to do, that's the law. And that's the law that I'm sworn to uphold. And I'm afraid that we're about to forget that. And we're here to remember that, to remember who we serve. If we make... Thank you. If we make the tragic mistake of allowing too much further media consolidation, we won't be able to undo it. Once companies merge, the FCC never asks them to unmerge. You just can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. The FCC could unalterably change the face of the American media for generations to come. This proceeding is so big, it feels like we're going straight to the Super Bowl without even having begun the regular season. The current FCC media ownership rules are grounded in three basic public policy goals: competition, localism, and diversity. They now make it difficult for one company to own both a newspaper and a television station serving the same community. They also cap the number of television or radio stations that one owner can control in a single area, as well as the number of television stations that one company can own nationwide. Another rule bars the four major TV broadcast networks from merging with one another. All of these rules are now up for grabs. The decisions we will soon make will have profound implications for our culture and for our society and for the politics and the level of civil discourse in this country. It'll affect the diversity of voices that are heard in this country in each of our communities, including the Bay Area. I think it's really sad that most Americans have heard nothing at all about the potential rule changes that we're about to make. I hope we can change that, and that's why I'm here today. But it's almost too late. The RFCC chairman, my chairman, Michael Powell, has vowed that nothing will stop the agency from overhauling these rules by June 2nd. That's about 37 days away. He even dismissed the recent congressional request for more information and more time. Earlier this month, a bipartisan group of 15 senators, including your very own Barbara Boxer, members of the Commerce Committee, asked the chairman to hold off on any changes until the FCC discloses more detail about its proposed rules so that Congress and the public can have the opportunity to respond. A similar letter followed from the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, which is concerned about protecting and promoting minority ownership in the media, as well as the impact of media consolidation on the Latino community. What was the chairman's response? He cast aside these congressional requests, announcing he's going to go forward full steam ahead despite these mounting concerns. So June 2nd is going to be a defining moment in the American media consolidation, in the history of American media consolidation. This issue is as important as any other one that the country faces right now, apart from war and peace. But guess what? The network media aren't even covering it. Some of you who watch public television might have seen last night that Bill Moyers on Now ran a program on this where he interviewed Barry Diller, who said he's extremely concerned about the direction that this is taking. This is somebody who's been one of the most successful broadcasters in the history of American journalism, and the networks won't put him on, but thank God for public broadcasting. Well, it's critical that we hear from the public before June 2nd. But to comment on the issues that are at stake, you, the American public, and your representatives in Congress need more information. There's rumors swirling all around the Capitol about the so-called diversity index and other approaches the FCC could take to overhaul these rules. But given that June 2nd is just 37 days away, a lot of people are understandably bewildered about what framework they'll face on June 3rd. Since we're charged with serving the public interest, the FCC should never be afraid of public comment. It only strengthens the ultimate product. It could help us avert unintended consequences. Perhaps most importantly, comment on a new plan is required by the law, as the Office of Advocacy of the U.S. Small Business Administration recently alerted our chairman. Now, Chairman Powell stated that the public has had every opportunity to respond to the notice that the FCC sent out last year. It was last September. The problem is that now we're crafting a whole new proposal, and the public has never had an opportunity to see it or to comment on any of the specifics. On an issue of this magnitude, the FCC has a legal and a moral obligation to provide the public with more specific information before sealing their fate into federal regulations. That's why, as a backstop, I recently asked the chairman, alert the public at least to the broad outlines of the plan in an open forum or a speech or something. Let them know the details. I even suggested let's do the public briefing in the context of the June 2nd time frame that you have, even though I don't think that's the best time frame. I think it's a rush to judgment. Something like this, which would fall short of the Administrative Procedure Act's full notice and comment procedures, would still go a long way to helping the public understand what's happening within the confined walls of the FCC. But he rejected that proposal as well, along with the others. And that's a sad, sad state of affairs, because the stakes in this proceeding couldn't be higher. The mass media shapes our thoughts, our decisions, and our values more than we might imagine, and perhaps more than they should. But given that reality, since our media ownership rules were first established, Americans have more forms of media than ever. And that's what those who argue that we can allow more consolidation say. But I question, does the availability of a greater number of channels necessarily translate into a greater number of diverse voices for accessing local news and information? I'm not so sure it does. I think our local communities are better served by hearing many voices discussing the issues of the day on a number of outlets, rather than just a handful of giant voices booming loudly across the range of media outlets that they own and control. Diverse views fuel our public debate and they strengthen our democracy. We need more voices in the nation's media, but not just from one ventriloquist. Now, a big issue before us is allowing a single company to own a variety of different media outlets, which is currently addressed by what we call our cross-ownership rules that we'll be hearing more about today. If the FCC jettisons these rules, what would we put in its place? I happen to believe that you could put something in its place. You could draft a properly crafted framework for assessing viewership across media in a particular local market, and that could serve as a proxy for the cross-ownership rules. But any gauge of diversity that the FCC employs has got to recognize the singular importance of media in the civic discourse and protect against too much concentration, given that fact. Because the media isn't like other consumer goods. Unlike cereal or ketchup, mass media has viewpoints attached to it. Control of the media affects the vibrancy of what the Supreme Court has called the, quote, uninhibited marketplace of ideas, unquote. It affects the very health of our democracy. Supreme Court has said, as a result of that, that the FCC may not abridge the right of Americans to have access to ideas and to creativity. Critics say that loosening the media ownership rules will unleash media giants to intensify their grip on the news business, drive local voices off the air, and block a variety of political viewpoints from reaching the airwaves. And the other side argues that consolidation can have positive effects, such as economies of scale. But our job is to protect the public, not corporations that naturally seek efficiencies. And what about the risks on the other side, especially the risk of losing what we call localism? Because television and radio stations in the U.S. are licensed to serve individual communities, both as outlets for local expression and local artists, and as sources of local news and information. The public deserves, and the laws require, programming that serves the unique needs of local communities. We've never given out national licenses in this country. We give them out to local communities. Consolidation, on the other hand, often leads to the homogenization of programming that so many people that I've spoken to at hearings like this across the country have said that they're fed up with. Evidence shows that television and newspapers are by far the most important sources of local news and public affairs information. Newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst understood the key power of local news outlets. I know you here in the Bay Area know a little something about Mr. Hearst and the power of local media. When asked why he preferred concentrating on newspapers with their limited regional appeal rather than spending more energy on motion pictures and their worldwide audience, he pithily replied, "I thought of it, but I decided against it. Because you can crush a man with journalism, but you can't with motion pictures." Now, we may be on the verge of creating a 21st century Citizen Kane, or maybe a handful of them. I've heard the arguments made by those seeking to abolish the newspaper television cross-ownership rule that common ownership is needed for newspaper companies to stay afloat or to produce better quality news. And sometimes that may be the case. But we've got to question whether mergers are the only ways that you can accomplish this. If efficiencies are gained by merging a newspaper with a TV station, couldn't we get the same benefits from a joint news gathering agreement between the two entities? That arrangement could at least preserve separate ownership and separate editorial and managerial control, which would help to ensure diverse viewpoints. We should decide if some of the claimed efficiencies can be gained short of an outright merger. Now, even assuming that newspapers are cash-strapped, which we hear from them, and I think it's debatable, what does that tell us? To me, it means there's a slim hope that we're going to see any new newspapers created in this country. So that means we better tread real carefully with the ownership of the few precious daily newspapers that still exist. Now, if you don't think changes in these rules can affect you, tune into today's radio. In 96, Congress, not the FCC, relaxed the rules that govern who can own radio stations in this country, and that prompted an unprecedented wave of consolidation in the radio business. In the first year after the act passed, more than 2,100 of the approximately 11,000 radio stations in this country changed hands. And most of these stations were sold to companies that already owned stations, many of them former competitors in exactly the same markets. Radio conglomerates now centralize broadcasting from remote headquarters and pump homogenized playlists into stations around the country. The largest radio group owns 1,240 stations, up from 40 before the rule change. There's a town in North Dakota from my neck of the woods called Minot that felt the effects of this recently. When a train carrying ammonia derailed and released a noxious cloud of gas, police sought to alert the community to steer clear. So they called the local radio stations, all six of which were owned by Clear Channel Communications. But the company had pared down its local operations, and nobody was there to pick up the phone. 300 people were hospitalized. For that community, loss of localism really resulted in tangible and devastating consequences. Now, I've compared the experience of the radio industry to the canary in the coal mine. Miners would send a canary down there first to make sure that it was safe before they entered. We'd better examine the health of this canary real carefully before we take any steps that might lead to consolidation in other media outlets like TV, cable, and newspapers. And what's the rush to make major changes now? The FCC should focus on putting in place a workable structure, one that survives scrutiny by the courts, as the chairman has said he wants to do, and then over time adjust the levels for greater amounts of consolidation after we've proven that the initial steps didn't hurt the public. The law provides a structure for the FCC to review these rules every 2 years. Why not focus now on implementing a workable structure and then work towards loosening in years to come as we learn more about the implications of greater consolidation on localism and on diversity and on the public? The FCC should proceed with a lot of caution in this area because our rules are designed to prevent a Citizen Kane-like figure from amassing way too much control over the media and over what we see, hear, and read and over the civic discourse. Caution and speed don't mix well in any context, particularly not when the safeguards of our democracy are at stake. So as we proceed at lightning speed now towards June 2nd, I hope that Chairman Powell provide the public with an inkling of what's to come so that we can debate the effect of any concrete proposals he discloses. That's what the public rulemaking proceeding should be all about. Each of you here today should be a part of that dialogue, and you are a part of that dialogue by being here and participating. I can't emphasize enough the importance of your participation, because if we're going to craft media ownership rules that best serve the public interest, we sure better hear from the public, and that's why I'm here to listen from you. So let's go to it and begin the discussion. Thank you all for being here this morning.
Now it's my great pleasure to introduce Ben Bogdikian, an intellectual treasure of the Bay Area. Ben Bogdikian is the author of 3 books on the media, including The Media Monopoly, I think a perfect title for today. He's the former assistant managing editor for national news at the Washington Post, the former dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California at Berkeley, and recipient of many awards, including the Peabody Award for Media Criticism. Ben Bogdikian.
Dean, thank you for the opportunity to speak at this hearing. I'm afraid that I've taken the words right out of your mouth. Since the frequencies are the property of the American public, it's fitting that a member of the Federal Communications Commission, a steward of the public property, gives us the owner citizens in the Bay Area an opportunity to be heard. I'd like to make 3 points that I think are significant in the stewardship of our airwaves. This is a fabulously valuable public property. According to the Statistical Abstract of the United States, the revenues of broadcasters and the associate telecommunication firms represent more than $300 billion a year. The channels through which this $300 billion industry makes its money are the property of the American public. It's the opinion of many citizens that this fabulous public resource that we own entitles us to have an effective voice on how our property is used. At the very least, the commercial users of our property ought to be required to give the people access to their programming until, and today, that has diminished so much till it's now almost close to zero in the big markets. Giving public property worth more than $300 billion to private corporations for their own profitable use is, in my opinion, an expropriation of a magnitude that reminds me of Teapot Dome. I think it's notable that large media conglomerates like AOL Time Warner, the largest media firm in the world, and Clear Channel, the largest radio group in the country, are said to own a certain number of stations. Legally, of course, they do not own the licenses for these stations. In a real sense, Their licenses are loaned to them for a specific period by us, the public, and according to the law, they are rented to them on condition that they operate, to quote the law, in the public interest. I suspect that few people who follow such things or read your op-ed piece recently and what you have said in public need to be reminded that the largest radio group in the country is Clear Channel. Clear Channel has more than 1,200 stations and has only 200 employees. They have 10 stations in the general San Francisco Bay Area. How can any company operate in the public interest when it operates 1,200 local radio stations with only 200 employees? Even in this period of genetic engineering, there is no way a radio station can be actively and locally run by 1/6 of a human being. But of course... Now, the reason that Clear Channel needs so few employees, that most of its stations have no human beings in them most of the time. The stations are operated remotely with canned programming. To tell the public to get indoors at once, close windows and doors against a deadly gas. The best local system to issue this emergency warning were the 6 stations the Clear Channel operates in the city of Minot. But the Clear Channel studios, though broadcasting during all this time, were empty and locked. They were operating with canned programming by remote control. Is there nothing the FCC can do to end this mockery of the law? Do these stations operate in the public interest of their communities? Furthermore, this company had 6 stations in a city with a population of 37,000. Why should a city of 37,000 people have the same owner for 6 stations? 6 stations with no human beings in them and using programming that had absolutely nothing to do with Minot, North Dakota. This seems to be greed raised to the 6th power. This kind of concentrated control by broadcasters is, I realize, permitted by the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which, in my opinion, was the most disastrous broadcasting legislation in our history. It effectively robbed people of their own airwaves. According to the Wall Street Journal, the 1994 Gingrich Republican caucus called in top broadcast executives, asked them what they wanted, and gave them the 1996 Act. It did so in the name of keeping up with new technology, a technology that permitted Clear Channel to dehumanize 6 radio stations in Minot, North Dakota. Now, Minot, North Dakota demonstrates the systemic negligence of the public interest throughout the country. But Clear Channel is not alone. Some time ago, I was interviewed on a major network with studios in San Francisco. Before we went on the air for the interview, the well-known host asked me not to mention where we were, not to mention the date, not to mention the day of the week, and not to mention the weather. He explained that this program is used in the network's other cities all over the country, and as he put it, we like people in all those cities to think they're listening to a local program. Clear Channel is not the only network that misuses the word local. I believe even under the disastrous 96 Act, the FCC still has responsibility to intervene when license holders so egregiously ignore the public interest. That phrase, to operate in the public interest, is still in the 1996 Act. Yet it has turned most of our radio talk shows into a right-wing propaganda machine. My second point is that we're speaking here about something close to the heart of sustaining our democracy. It is too often overlooked that it is uniquely necessary for the United States public to have routine access to the broadcast stations in their own communities. We are unique because the United States is the only developed democracy in the world that leaves so many central functions of government to each locality. Each of our cities operates its own schools, its own police, its own land use, most of its taxes, and other functions that in other countries are the responsibility of centralized national agencies. No purely national programming can possibly report on these for us. Why else would almost all our broadcast licenses require that the licensee to maintain a station in its city of operation? Yet we are close to imitating other countries who have all their significant broadcasts originate in their capital or central city and then send out to the whole country by mechanical translator towers. In those countries, every community gets the same programming, and that in effect for their own legislation, that's all they need. The United States is almost alone in requiring a broadcast license holder to operate a studio in each city and for a valid fundamental reason. But by now, that requirement has become close to meaningless for most chain broadcasters. That is why it seems contrary to the national welfare that most of our major local broadcast outlets, not just Clear Channel, send out program where all of them could just as well originate in Enid, Oklahoma. We need more civic discussion on our local stations, and I don't mean bad jokes about local matters by shock jocks and disc jockeys, and not at midnight. The public interest requires more broadcast sessions that permit rational discussion and audience participation. We in the Bay Area, at KQED's Michael Krasny, who hosts an excellent issue program, we have the Pacifica station, KPFA, which has... KPFA has progressive news and programming, a political orientation that is constantly criticized by many of the same organizations that are happy that almost all the national talk shows are from the political far right, as with Rush Limbaugh, who, as you know, is syndicated by Clear Channel. But Clear Channel alone has 10 stations in our market. Today, all over the country, our cities and states are facing financial crises in budgets for schools, for other city services, for all the duties that come from our system of local governance. We are the richest country in the world, but we are now shrinking our school curricula, reducing our civic services, and at the same time demanding that our school children improve their performance. Our form of democracy needs routine information throughout the year on issues we all face on Election Day. The country has a unique need for local civic discussion on the air. It is a unique requirement needed to maintain our unique form of democracy. My third point is that FCC policy in the last 30 years has permitted five large media conglomerates to own the media on which a majority of Americans say they depend upon for their news, information, and entertainment. Each of these giant conglomerates has major holdings in all our major media, newspapers, magazines, books, cable, radio, television, and motion pictures. We're a nation of 380 million people in 19,000 cities and towns stretched across a great continent. Our population is a world model of diversity, of ethnicity, race, and countries of national origin. We have clear differences in our geographic regions and their differing regional cultures and needs. We now suffer an unnecessary disconnect between the needs of our local governments and the diverse nature of our population on one hand, and on the other hand, the lack of this diversity in our broadcasting system. In recent years, that gap has widened even more rapidly and has been propagandized so consistently by the broadcasting industry that there are now men and women in powerful government and industrial positions who question the need to regulate broadcasting at all. The problem is intensified by the high degree to which both radio and television stations duplicate each other. If one network finds a profitable program formula, the others rush to imitate it, and it almost forms what is a cartel. In their imitated programming, a large amount of what the public hears, as I said, is right-wing, of the most crudely aggressive kind. In stark contrast to what most serious polls is the self-identified politics of the American population. And since cancellation of fairness doctrine in 1980, in the 19 individuals and organizations attacked no longer have the right to reply. Let me state what I think is a fallacy repeated endlessly to justify deregulation of broadcasting. It is constantly repeated that there are so many new channels that we no longer need to regulate them. There are many new channels. What are these new channels? Mainly cable and satellite broadcasting. But these new channels do not operate as separate corporate entities. Even a working paper commissioned by the FCC noted there are many new channels, but the number of owners remains stagnant. The arithmetic is inescapable. More channels and the same number of owners means that the new channels simply increase the power and control of the existing oligopoly that controls most United States broadcasting. The owners of our new cable channels, for example, are AT&T, AOL Time Warner, Viacom, General Electric's NBC subsidiaries, Disney Company, and Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. The repeated assertion of new channels, including satellite broadcasting, is now dominated by Murdoch's recent purchase of DirecTV and EchoStar, that owns 6 satellites with 500 channels of video, audio, and data. We speak here of a handful of global corporations that control everything that a majority of Americans say they use to get their news. And this handful of giant corporations so imitate each other, chasing after ratings and sharing ownership in so many joint ventures, that our thousands of broadcast outlets becomes meaningless if we have a goal of meeting the needs of our diverse population. The new channels, by increasing the media power of existing companies, introduce a threat to the kind of democracy we deserve. We know all too well that media power means political power in Washington. And what James Madison said more than 200 years ago was still true, that a popular government without popular information is a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. That is why I think the FCC is one of the most crucial agencies in maintaining the health of our democracy. And in closing, let me say we're grateful that you recognize this responsibility by your presence here today. Thank you.
Our first panel of the day will be on news and civic discourse, and the moderator is Heather Hudson. We have 4 speakers who will speak for about 6 to 8 minutes, and then we will have a number of the public who will comment. And I'm just going to introduce Heather Hudson. Heather is the professor and director of the Telecommunications Management and Policy Program in the School of Business at the University of San Francisco. She's written numerous books and articles on domestic and international telecommunications policies. She's also planned and evaluated communications projects in more than 50 countries and consulted for state and federal government agencies, telecommunications companies, and consumer and international organizations. Heather Hudson.
Thank you very much, and welcome to everyone. And I would personally like to thank Commissioner Edelstein for bringing the FCC outside the Beltway and taking regulation to the people all the way to the West Coast. That was, I think, what the original intent was, and we are very glad to have you here. Thank you so much. I will introduce the 4 speakers on this panel, and then we will have opportunities for brief comments from people from the floor who have indicated an interest in speaking. The first speaker is John McManus, who directs Grade the News, a web-based project at Stanford that does for print and broadcast news in the Bay Area what Consumer Reports magazine does for cars and computers, which evaluates stations and newspapers head-to-head. He's a former journalist and journalism professor and has written a book called Market-Driven Journalism, Let the Citizen Beware, which won a research prize from the Society of Professional Journalists. And we welcome you. And we will try to keep the comments to 6 to 8 minutes. I will try to be draconian. I hope I don't need to be, but we want to hear from as many people as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Commissioner, for calling this. Can I be heard throughout the room? Is that okay? That's probably an advantage. Who owns a television station or newspaper for that matter? Wouldn't greatly matter, I think, if each newsroom were governed by the norms of journalism, able to use the profits it generates to maximize public understanding of current events and issues. That's what journalism is supposed to be about. But I was noticing in the New York Times of Monday, April the 7th, a story about Rupert Murdoch and his empire, which spans the globe, television stations, a network, obviously Fox, lots of newspapers, cable ownership and about to expand. Satellite ownership and about to expand. And all of these English-speaking outlets of Mr. Murdoch's, for some reason, reflect his very conservative political views. Ownership does matter. The push for convergence of ownership necessarily into fewer and larger corporations is really, I think, part of a larger trend in American news media since at least the mid-1980s. And what I would call that is the economic rationalization of newsrooms. As the news becomes not a business with important public service components that might reduce profit, but a business like any other, with managers seeking to maximize shareholder or owner returns, we would expect the push for convergence in order to reduce competition in the marketplace. Not surprisingly, research has shown that lessening competition among news media tends to reduce journalism quality. Economic rationalization seeks to exploit economies of scale, spreading fewer reporters over more stories. That means less time to gather the whole story and put it in context. And it gives packagers of stories, public relations people who are typically employed by wealthier corporations and not by the poor, greater influence over the news agenda. Economic rationalization seeks to increase market power over viewers, readers, and advertisers. Citizens have fewer real choices as multiple outlets feature the same reporters covering the news under the same corporate constraints. Advertisers will have to pay more because they will have fewer alternatives for reaching masses of the public. A little more on the fundamental trend of economic rationalization. I think it probably has its antecedents with Al Newhart and Gannett when he discovered that business principles, when ruthlessly applied to journalism, made news the darling of Wall Street. And both Gannett and Newhart could become very wealthy. News execs, in fact, no longer speak of cities or metropolitan areas or audiences to be served, but markets. Readers and viewers aren't citizens, but customers. News isn't a department of local TV stations, but a profit center. Beyond these words lie very different definitions of news. The journalistic definition of news is information, that information which is most important to the largest number of people in the community. There's no economic part of that equation, of that definition, other than that you are obligated to spend as much as you can, but not so much that you lose your economic viability. That might be an average profit, say 9% return before taxes return, as opposed to typical returns in the news industry, which are in the 20 and 30% range. The economic model, the economic selection model for news is a little more complicated. One should choose news based on essentially a cost-benefit analysis. And the costs are discovering that the news is happening in the first place, sending reporters out on beats rather than taking press releases or listening to the scanner radio. The cost of writing the story up, of assembling it, of talking to all the parties who are interested. The potential cost of offending advertisers, who are the major supporters of newspapers and the only supporters of commercial television. And the news ought to be directly proportional, the content of the news, to that which appeals to certain audiences that advertisers are interested in reaching, and not others. And advertisers are most interested in the 25 to 54 demographic, people who have not formed consumer preferences that are hard to shake with 30-second ad spots, and people who are in their prime buying years. This, of course, excludes young people, it excludes older people, and it excludes people with less customer potential. Hardly a democratic definition of journalism. Ever since FCC Chairman Mark Fowler mistook television for a toaster with pictures, the FCC has encouraged this market-based vision that equates commercial success with public service. The proposal to allow greater concentration of ownership promises to build upon this fundamental misconception in ways that diminish the independent flow of information upon which self-government necessarily depends. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Our next speaker is Brenda Payton, who is familiar to many people for her writing and radio work in the Bay Area. She writes a thrice-weekly column for the Oakland Tribune, does monthly commentaries for KQED Public Radio. She's worked for the San Francisco Examiner, Boston Phoenix, and the New Bedford Standard Times. She was the recipient of a Knight Fellowship and has taught reporting at feature writing at San Francisco State. Brenda.
Good morning. I hope some of the experiences in my 28 years of working for newspapers will illustrate why I think further consolidation of media outlets and cross-ownership undermine the crucial role newspapers play in the civic discourse. Consolidation limits the perspective, reduces the competition, distances the ownership from the community and its values, and creates a centralization of media control that begs to be abused. Early in my career, I worked in Boston when the city was rocked by racial violence and tension related to school desegregation. It was a frightening time in Boston that left lasting scars. As there are now, there were two major daily newspapers with very different viewpoints. The Boston Globe was liberal, appealing to the views of the city's college-educated population that generally supported busing, also in large part because it didn't affect their children. The Boston Herald was more conservative, closer to the viewpoints of the city's white working class that opposed busing and was highly impacted by the busing proposals or programs. Back then, when I read the Herald, I usually got angry. But it was important for the city, maybe even essential to its survival, to have two newspapers that reflected two differing viewpoints. Together, they were able to give both sides of this highly polarized issue a voice. They provided an avenue for the two sides to at least see, if not understand, the other point of view. If there had been only one paper, whole sectors of the city would have found themselves without a voice. I can't help but think that would have led to additional frustration, alienation, and violence. Boston was eventually able to heal those wounds, and years later, when public housing was desegregated, the process went relatively smoothly, much more smoothly than school desegregation. The city had grown from its traumatic experience with school desegregation, and having two newspapers helped it make the positive change. Boston still has two daily newspapers, but since then, many cities that did have two have only one. When I moved to the Bay Area, I worked for the San Francisco Examiner, the old San Francisco Examiner. Even though the X and the San Francisco Chronicle were in a joint operating agreement, the news staffs were highly competitive. At the Examiner, we thought of ourselves as the underdog, but we took pride in being scrappy and frequently scooped the competition. Of course, Chronicle reporters would tell you they frequently scooped the X, and both things are true. That good old newspaper competition resulted in both staffs digging deeper, making that extra phone call, knocking on that additional door. Editors were more likely to pay for an out-of-town trip or overtime to nail a good story. The Bay Area was more vigorously and thoroughly covered when there were two fully functioning papers. Now, with the Examiner as not even a shadow of itself, the Chronicle is essentially the only daily in town. Besides offering varied points of view and competition, the more newspapers and media outlets you have, the more eyes and minds you have looking at an issue and communities, and the more likely that together they will see more angles and nuances. Even if a paper doesn't have an identifiable political bent, which probably most do, each one has a distinct culture that influences what is considered newsworthy, what is emphasized, what's above the fold, what is ignored or just missed. If there are fewer papers, reporters and editors and photographers from these various newspaper cultures, it's more likely, or I should say media cultures, it's more likely they'll see things in a similar way and more of the complete story will be missed. Newspapers have done a poor job of reflecting the growing diversity of the population in their staffs. According to the annual newsroom census of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, people of color comprise only 12.5% of newsroom staffs, while they make up 31.1% of the population. The late Robert Maynard, the first African-American editor and publisher of a mainstream daily newspaper, understood that diversity in the newsroom led to better coverage, not only of communities of color, but of the news in general. Ownership of multiple media outlets is particularly problematic. Newspapers play a role distinct from television or radio. They don't have the immediacy, but they can offer analysis, perspective, and background the electronic media can't. The act of reading engages the brain and thinking processes in ways that foster analysis and questioning. I'm not saying newspapers aren't often superficial and sensational. They are. But the reader still has the ability to think for him or herself, to turn the page, turn back to the article, and read it again. And if they haven't used it to line the bottom of the birdcage, they can even go back to it a week later to see if the information still stands up. As more U.S. citizens rely on television for news, the newspaper's role is all the more important. It's particularly important in a community that television news and the newspaper are not owned by a single company. The prism of reality would be narrowed with both outlets influenced by one culture. That narrowness would be detrimental to a community where more populations and issues would not show up in the news. Thinking back to Boston during busing, I believe the narrow focus and sense of exclusion would undermine a community's ability to understand itself and its issues. I've talked about the inadvertent biases and oversights of media monopoly, but consolidation and cross-ownership also create opportunities for purposeful manipulation of information to benefit the owner. We like to pretend media owners would never do such a thing, but you only have to look at the history of some of the nation's newspaper monopolies to see that it has happened, and you only have to look at the blackout about these proposed FCC changes to see that it continues to happen. With a more diverse population in so many ways, we need more voices coming from more points of view, not fewer voices and perspectives that will be the result of cross-ownership and consolidation. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Amy Cesara, who's an activist with the Youth Media Council, where she was involved in the creation of the Bay Area Media Map, a youth organizer's guide to the media turf in the Bay Area and beyond, and of the 2002 community assessment is KMEL, the People's Station. Amy's also worked for several years in the Filipino-American community, particularly fighting for environmental justice for communities impacted by military toxic waste in the Philippines. Amy.
Thank you very much. I'm here on behalf of the Youth Media Council. We're a youth organizing, media capacity building, and watchdog project. We work with several Bay Area organizations to build media capacity and organize for media accountability and improve coverage for youth. We present the following study, which has been published as a publication called Speaking for Ourselves, to show that for communities of color, youth, and marginalized communities, media coverage is already inaccurate and incomplete, and further media consolidation could only worsen these conditions. Although children make up one quarter of the U.S. population, they account for only 10% of all news stories. The public depends on the news media to understand its children and youth. 76% of the public say that they form their opinions about social issues like crime from what they read and watch in the news. Despite a steady decline in national juvenile crime rates, two-thirds of the public still believe crime is rising. The disparity between coverage of youth and the real life conditions of youth has resulted in a generation that has been killed, locked up, or locked out. Known as the campaign research team of the Youth Media Council, these 15 teens joined with us and studied the role of news in society, the laws and issues of privatization affecting news coverage and its impact on policy and public opinion. The CRT examined 3.5 months of news coverage from the Bay Area's number one news station, KTVU Channel 2, asking the questions, who is speaking most in coverage of youth? Is context given to youth, to stories about crime, poverty, and education in coverage? And what are the most covered issues about youth? What we found was, one, a disproportionate focus on crime. Two, stories about pets and animals appeared more than 4 times as often as stories about youth poverty. Three, for each story about youth and poverty, there were 11 stories about youth and crime. Four, youth voices of all races were missing while the voices of white adults were amplified. Five, law enforcement and politicians were quoted more often than any other source. Six, KTVU lacked coverage of racial justice and the voices of youth of color were especially absent. Seven, only one story mentioned the declining rate of juvenile crime. Eight, more than half of the stories examined failed to discuss solutions to problems raised in coverage. And nine, when solutions were offered, more than 83% focused on policing and punishment. The campaign research team came up with several recommendations based on these findings, and here are a few of them. Balance stories about youth and crime with stories about youth poverty, education, and youth organizing. Link racial bias to inequity in stories about crime, education, and poverty. Let youth speak for themselves in stories about youth. And another one is balance news coverage of youth by quoting youth advocates and public defenders. As I said, this study was published as a publication called Speaking for Ourselves. And something else that the group has achieved is last month, KTVU partnered with the Youth Media Council to do something called the Youth Journalist Roundtable. And it was a successful event, including 15 journalists in attendance, 10 youth organizations. And after that, dialogue, 3 stories came out of that were covered about youth issues. In conclusion, media consolidation is not merely an academic or legal issue. It affects the quality of news content, which impacts policy decisions. By limiting the range of sources and narrowing the scope of policy and debate in news coverage, media consolidation silences the voices and perspectives on life and death issues for people of color, poor people, youth, and other marginalized communities. Two, consolidation increases the criminalization of youth in the news. Youth are particularly vulnerable to the effects of media consolidation on news coverage. As policy debate and news coverage narrows, those that do not have the right to vote and are not perceived as a relevant audience lose the most. Three, marginalized communities can and should be leading the fight to make the FCC do their job and hold news outlets accountable to the public interest. Thank you.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. We're listening to a public hearing on the concentration of ownership in the media. The hearing took place on April 26th in San Francisco, California. We continue.